Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Seeking Justice on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin, and for the next hour and a half, I will be your co-host, and along with Kim Colton. Kim, good evening.
Oh, hi, Denny. It's good to be here tonight. How are you?
I am very good, thank you, and I'm very excited about our show tonight. It's going to be, I think, very special, and without further ado, I'll let you go ahead and introduce our guests.
Okay, well, first I'd like to say that tonight we'll be discussing the Debbie Whitlock case, and on March 25th, 1988, 32-year-old Debbie Whitlock was murdered and then raped in her Modesto, California home. Initially, Debbie's husband, Harold, was a suspect in his wife's murder, but he was never charged. 9 years passed without an arrest, but Debbie's mother, Jackie McDonald, never lost hope that the case would eventually be solved. She pursued her own investigation into her daughter's death, leaving no stone unturned. Her dedication was rewarded in 1997 with the arrest and conviction of the killer. An account of the case titled No Room for Doubt was written by Debbie's stepdaughter, Angela Dove, and was released last year. Our guests for this evening are Jackie McDonald, mother of Debbie Whitlock. Jackie is very active in support of victims of crime. She has a TV show sponsored by the local college called The Victim's Voice. She received the National Crime Victim Service Award from the United States Attorney General. She has appeared on 2020 America's Most Wanted, has been featured in Newsweek and People Magazine, and the Oxygen Channel did a special with her. And Jackie will soon be coming to Blog Talk Radio, I hope. Our other guest is Lisa DeSantis. Lisa is the program coordinator for the Victim Witness Program in Merced County, California, District Attorney's Office. And, of course, we have Angela Dove, Debbie's stepdaughter, Debbie Whitlock's stepdaughter, Harold Whitlock's daughter, author of No Room for Doubt. Angela was the last person to see and speak to Debbie on the night she was murdered. Well, Jackie, let's start with you first. If you could you take us back to March of 1988 and tell us what happened?
Well, thank you, first of all, for having me on radio and with my friends.
Yes.
What happened was we were living in Minnesota because my second husband, Dennis, was a pilot for Northwest Airlines. Now he's Delta. We merged. I have to say that. And it's funny because it was a beautiful day in Minnesota. It wasn't nasty for a change. And my mother-in-law was going to come from California and visit us that night. But during the day, the chief pilot had called wanting to speak to Dennis. And I thought, why would he want to speak to my husband? He's a tremendous pilot, you know, there's no problems. Mm-hmm. Little did I know that my son-in-law had called and wanted to contact my husband so he could tell me of my daughter's murder. I remember when, I'll never forget it, when they came home, and I'll try and be brief, when Dennis and his mom came to the house, I said to him, you know, before we settle in, you've got to call the chief pilot, and then we can have the evening to just sit around and talk and drink tea. And he walked into the family room, and he looked so strange. And I asked him, I said, well, what happened? And he said, sit down. And I said, no, I'm standing up. What's the matter? And he said, Debbie. Oh, Cliff called, and I said, oh, my God, Karen. And he said, no, Debbie. And my husband swears he didn't say this, but this is what I heard. He said, somebody cut her throat. And that's when the music died. The next thing I know, he found me wandering up and down the street outside in shock. Called our doctor, who was not on call. I was out of town, so, of course, there was nobody to help me. But friends came over, and the minister came over. And basically, you know, it was a blur. You want to go in the bedroom. You want to hide behind the nightstand and block the world out. And the next day, you're hoping it was a nightmare. Mm-hmm. But actually, it was a nightmare that I would live for a few years.
What transpired the night before? And now Debbie was a young mother.
Yes.
Her daughter was she
three. Courtney was three.
And she was married to a man named Harold.
Yes.
And Harold is the one that found her, correct?
Yes, and he had been at a bachelor party at Garcia's restaurant because Tony Garcia was their best friend. So, you know, you always have your parties at your friend's restaurant. And mm-hmm. he came home expecting to find Debbie asleep in bed and instead found her body in the hallway.
Mm.
And then we, of course, when we were on Dateline, they played the tape of him calling, 911?
911, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, oh, my daughter, I have to go and check on my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God that Courtney had slept through it. Because
thank God.
What would have happened to her if she'd woke up? Because normally, from what Debbie would tell me, Courtney would wake up about 2 in the morning and go and climb in bed with her parents. But that night she didn't, and I feel only through the grace of God did she not wake up. And
mm-hmm.
also because Debbie, I don't believe that Debbie made a sound. I believe that she died silently.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure she had thoughts of Courtney.
Well, you know, as a mother, that's what you do, don't you? You protect
mm-hmm.
your child at any cost.
Right.
To you.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, you know, that was it. I was in shock. And the next day when I woke up, of course, I did not want to come back to California because I felt that if I didn't come back to California, and this sounds absolutely ludicrous, but if I didn't come back here, Debbie wasn't dead. And I have always said I have to be totally honest about what I went through and how I felt. Because of what I do now, I can't expect other victims, and I absolutely despise that word. I cannot expect
mm-hmm.
them to tell me how they feel if I cannot tell them the truth about my own feelings.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
But there was some, I just kind of wanted to touch a little bit with Harold. He had gone out to a bachelor party that night.
Yes.
And he didn't get home, and he didn't discover her till it was about 5 o'clock in the morning, right?
I'll be honest, I'm not quite sure what time that was.
Okay.
You know, there are a lot of things that I didn't know until I started reading Angela's book because she researched so thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to remember that in the beginning, the police don't really tell you that much.
Right, and I'll tell you, that's a wonderful book, No Room for Doubt, by Angela Dove. It's fantastic.
And can I say,
well,
I'm proud to say I asked her to write it.
Oh.
because she loved Debbie and she lived there. So who better to write a book about someone you love and knew personally?
Mm-hmm. But 9 years went by, and really the only suspect they had was Harold, and you knew in your heart that he had nothing to do with this.
I was his biggest defender. I mean, I knew he didn't do it. And I can tell you one reason why I knew he wouldn't have done it, because he would never have left Courtney in the house with her dead mother.
Right.
Simple, you know, apart from the fact mm-hmm. I knew that it wasn't in his nature to be,
mm-hmm.
You know, to be a bully or to be, you know, hit somebody or hurt somebody. He was a
mm-hmm.
nice man. He really was.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Where should we go from here, Jackie? What else would you like to talk about with the case? There were so many. And actually, you went to the Victims Witness Program in the county there, that's in California, where Debbie lived.
Well, what happened was, of course, we were home. We had the when I came home for her funeral, I said to my daughter, I have to buy a black dress. And she said, no, Mother, we're wearing blue because that was Debbie's favorite color. And then Debbie was cremated. And I remembered that when they handed me that little box, you know, to bury her. It finally hit me, because you're in a tunnel when this first happens. There's so many people around you. You're in a tunnel. That when I saw her name on that little box, I realized that Debbie was actually dead. And I actually looked at the sky and I thought, and forgive my language, but what the hell am I going to do for the rest of my life without her? And I got back to Minnesota, and I was on the telephone to Unsolved Mysteries. Actually, I called them for 6 years. America's Most Wanted took four, and I hired a psychic. And then one day, don't ask me why, I saw a regular person on a local channel, and I thought, well, why can't I do that? And that's when we started The Victim's Voice.
Fantastic.
It was 1996. But basically all I did was call television shows trying to get on. I just wanted to get her name and face out there.
And that would be very, very important, because the killer had yet to be caught.
Well, it was 9 years. The police told me that actually he hadn't told anybody, that no one knew. And I said, one person knows. Because when you do something so horrendous, the adrenaline is pumping and you have to tell one person. And I was correct.
He did.
Yes, but it took 9 years for this man to come forward.
And a big reason why he came forward, because he was so haunted by Debbie's picture on the billboards.
Well, actually, in court, he said the one word I wanted to hear, those words that... Her eyes followed me everywhere, because one day I thought, why can't I have a billboard, you know? And so I tried for over 2 years by myself and couldn't. And then another friend, Janelle Riley, whose daughter was murdered in Orange, said there's a new group in town called Citizens Against Homicide, and I called them. And within 3 months, I had my billboard. And then I thought, well, why can't we go in the bus system? So we went in the bus system, and then one day pizza came to the house, and I thought, huh, why can't we put the flyers on the Pizza Hut takeout? You want me to go on? It's a mini series.
Yeah. Well, that is exactly the right thing to do, because it made him feel as if her eyes were following him. He just couldn't forget about it.
And then shopping carts. My mom had passed and left me a little money, and so what better to use some of it for the shopping carts at the biggest department store near where Debbie lived. So that's all I thought about. 1 year it was the Boy Scouts that put flyers out all the way from Merced all the way through to Modesto with who murdered Debbie. You know, so that's all I thought about. Where can I put her face?
Well, let's see here. Angela, let's bring you on now, because I do want to talk about that night. You were the last one to see and speak to Debbie. And interestingly, you thought your dad was home, because you thought you heard something in your parents' bedroom, correct? Or in your dad's bedroom.
Right, that's correct. And, you know, at the time, I did believe that it was my father who was sleeping back there. And it really, you know, I don't even think I would have noticed except that I was trying to get back to my sister's bedroom without waking her up, and I didn't turn on the hall light. So I guess when the lights are out, sounds tend to be a bit amplified. And so I kind of registered, there's my dad sleeping, walking past his room into my sister's room, gave her a little kiss and left. And, you know, I didn't find out for another 2 days that my father wasn't in the house at that point. And that's certainly always been something that I've struggled to make sense of.
I was gonna ask you if you had ever came to some sort of conclusion as to who that was, or if you had heard it. I'm sure you've gone back and forth.
Right. You know, ultimately, the police weren't able to determine who could have been back there. So I just don't know. But I don't think that, I've had several people ask me about that since the book was released. And, you know, they want desperately to know, and my only answer is, yeah, me too.
Exactly. And Debbie seemed to be in good. You had a very close relationship with her.
We were pretty close. I mean, she was very supportive of my relationship with my father, which was not always easy. You know, I didn't even live on the same coast with him all the time, so it was a bit of a struggle to have a close relationship with him. And when I was talking about moving in with them, you know, Debbie was she did everything but pull out pom-poms and go into a cheer. I mean, she was just that supportive of it.
And that is wonderful.
It's wonderful. There are not a lot of stepmothers who would do that for their
no
teenage stepdaughter, but she was just incredibly
right
supportive of that. And you know, so we had a good relationship, and I hope that if she had felt like she was in danger that night, that I would have picked up on that. I mean, maybe that's hubris, but that nothing about her reaction during our little conversation about my spring break vacation, you know, nothing set off alarm bells at all. You know, I came in, borrowed a suitcase, chit-chatted, kissed my sister, chit-chatted, left. And everything was fine, except that 2 hours later, she was dead and nothing was fine anymore.
Right, right. And it wasn't. Now, do you want, I was thinking now, Jackie, when you, during, before the killer was caught, you did go to the local victim witness program in your in that county, correct? And tell us a little bit about what they did for you.
Well,
and then I want to bring Lisa on to discuss too.
Well, actually, I remember because it was in a small like a little bungalow, would you call it? It's a little apartment. And there were photographs of victims on the wall. There we go again with that victim. It was just a place that you could go, and it's the same now where, with Lisa. You can go there, you can have a cup of coffee, and nobody judges you. Because sometimes you may seem strange to the, you know, to a person that hasn't gone through it. Because a lot of times, I call it the tunnel when it first happens. You can speak to people, but you're really not there. And I could cry. I could speak about Debbie. I could do what I wanted, and nobody judged me. And that's what's so wonderful about it. And the thing is that, and Lisa is the one qualified to tell you what victim witness can do for you, but for me, I will always be eternally grateful for those young women that were there.
Wonderful. And Lisa, let's bring you on. We'll throw you into this mix here. hello, first. Let me say hello. And this is such an important. Every county has a victim witness program, and I'll bet you not everybody even knows that. I mean, I knew I had one in my community, but I don't have any idea what they do. And they do a lot, actually. From when I was talking to you, I couldn't believe at least in your county. Tell me a little bit about what someone like that come in that's been through this like Jackie has, and tell me what kind of assistance you have for them. What can you do for them?
Well, I think one of the things we have to keep in mind, and a lot of people tend to put stereotypes, and they always want to think that, well, you know, it could happen to you, but not to me. And we have to remember that you take away gender, you take away nationality, you take away all of those things. First and foremost, we are human beings. And I think we tend to forget those things because so many times I hear, well, but I'm, you know, I'm working or I'm perhaps not legally here. How can I be eligible for this program? None of those things matter. What matters is that you're a human being and you need to be treated with respect and dignity and compassion. So when we have victims that come into our office, one of the things we want to make sure is they are being treated fairly and they are being treated with dignity and respect. And I know we hear this all the time, you treat others like you would want to be treated, but it's so very true. We have to remember the person that you're sitting across from, that you're trying to comfort and explain what could possibly happen in the judicial process, you have to remember that person can be anybody, including your own family. Mm-hmm. And we get so far away from that so many times that we lose track of, you know, the human race. So
right.
Many times what we'll do is make sure that first you let them get accustomed to you. You let them talk. You let them express their concerns. And you listen. And let them know that you are there to help them out, to help them through that process, which many people don't understand how the judicial process works. A lot of people mm-hmm. don't understand what takes place when a crime has occurred. What next? You know, we make sure that we are in contact with the detectives, the police departments, and most definitely the district attorney. There's three types of victim witness centers. You have a community-based, probation-based, and district attorney-based. So obviously, being that we are part of the district attorney's office, we're going to be contacting our district attorneys who are particularly handling that case. We want to bring them in and let them know what the victim's concerns are. We're really the voice for that person who is unable to speak because of the trauma that they're experiencing. So what we're trying to do is alleviate some of the trauma that they are experiencing. It's not going to go totally away, but you can help them through that process.
Mm-hmm.
So
you take some of the stress off. Definitely.
Yeah, I think what happens too is when a lot of folks don't know, like for example, I'll give you an example. Somebody receives a subpoena, what's the first thing that happens? Oh my gosh, I have to go to court, what for? The anxiety mm-hmm. level is so high. They're having to face their perpetrator and they're having to see this person in the courtroom. Okay? We are adults, we understand how things work much better than children many times. Children have to be called into court to testify. So what we try to do is explain to them, this is what's going to happen, this is what you don't need to expect, and guess what? You don't need to go to court by yourself. And I always encourage people, do not go to court by yourself. Come to our office. From our office, we will go over to court with you, and we will transport you there. It's not very far. It's a few blocks away, but we don't want you to be there alone. You're in a chaotic environment. Because nobody knows, I mean, people who are in the audience don't quite know what's going on. And you want to be there to explain to them what's happening. What are the attorneys doing right now? Are they talking about settling the case? And if they are, they're going to consult or talk to everybody involved. You know, and mm-hmm. we have to keep in mind that when you're thrown into an unknown situation, it's scary just not knowing what's going to happen. Once you've explained, the anxiety level decreases. And what happens is you start building a rapport with these folks, which is exactly what you need to do anyway, because you're going to be by their side for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are we offering them that type of support, but there are many times where, for example, victims have incurred medical bills as a result of a crime. The program, once they have applied through the program can pay for those medical expenses. Perhaps even death.
Fantastic. That's
and
fantastic.
Even funeral expenses. One of the things that I tend to encourage is counseling, because I have seen a huge difference in folks when they come in and they've applied for counseling services and they have been going to counseling for quite some time. And it's not for everybody. But giving it a try and knowing what tools to use, especially, you know, when we're dealing with folks who are very traumatized, a lot of times they're not going to, a lot of the things you're going to be telling them, they're not going to retain, and that's perfectly fine. And we usually tell them, you know what, ask 5 times, it doesn't matter, that's what we're here for. We expect that you're going to be asking the same questions over and over because you're in trauma. You're not going to retain a lot of the things that we tell you. And we're also not going to overload you with a lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
The sad thing about, I'm sorry.
No, no, go ahead.
You can interrupt me at any time, Kim.
No, no. It reminds me of almost, it really reminds me of being in the medical field, because that's what you got. You need to treat patients really in the same way, because if they don't know what they're, what's going to happen? What do you mean I have to have this test? What do you mean I have to, what is going to happen? And you have to have somebody there with compassion and support that will guide them through this, really. It just, it reminds me of that same type of thing. That's
Kim,
all I was going to say.
You know,
Kim, this is Angela. That's, that's such a good analogy, I think, because just thinking it through, you know, if I had to choose, if I have a disease, I want a doctor who knows what they're doing more than a doctor who has a good bedside manner. But if I can get that doctor and also somebody there who has the bedside manner, who can hold my hand and walk me through it, then that's the dynamic duo. I mean, that's what you
mm-hmm.
want. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's what victim witness does in a way, especially when they work with a DA's office. If your mm-hmm. case is going to trial, you know, then chances are you want an attorney who's more of a gunslinger than a handholder, if you have
mm-hmm.
to choose.
Mm-hmm.
And victim witness is there to provide a little bit more of the humanity and hankies end of it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And may I say something? I'm sorry. Can I say something about therapy? Because I actually did go. I went to see, and her name is Midjack, and she was wonderful. And the reason I went is because when you sit down as a family and you talk, it ends in a crying fest. So you need someone who can sit there, and you can still get sympathy, but there's this sort of, you know, the barrier. They're not going to sit and cry. They're just going to listen to you and give you good advice. And we would have a cup of coffee, and she'd have chocolate because she knows how I'm a chocoholic. And I said to her once, you know, Midge, if I go off the wrong edge, you tell me. And she said, Jackie, my problem was that I had to know how to channel my anger. Mm-hmm. And then we know what happened. I started trying to help other people and trying to find
mm-hmm.
Debbie Stiller.
And I think it's hard for people who are victims of crime to turn to their friends.
Mm-hmm.
Because one thing that one of the gals in our chat room is talking about is that people have a tendency to distance themselves
mm-hmm.
from those who have had tragedy, almost as if it might be transmitted to them.
Right.
People would always say, how are you doing? And you'd look in their eyes and it's, I hope she doesn't tell me.
Right.
So, you know, I just say, oh, fine. You know, and mm-hmm. that's the standard reply.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, if I could just add, Kim,
mm-hmm.
I always tell folks when they come in and they've applied for our program, for the services, I always tell them, I encourage them to get the counseling. But I usually say, because so many people are reluctant to go to counseling, we have this misconception that, you know, you're crazy, something's wrong with you. But what do we do when we have a toothache? We go to a dentist.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do when we have problems with our feet? We go to a podiatrist, right? We go to
mm-hmm.
specialists. But when we're having a difficult time understanding some of the reactions we have in a traumatic situation, or even if it's not a traumatic situation, what do we do? You know, sometimes
right.
we need that professional to help us through that process and help us to be able to put those tools into use so that we're better able to handle the situation when it arises. I have a lot of parents who come in and they don't know how to react when their children come to them, you know, and they've disclosed that they have been sexually molested. And so the parents are so lost when the children come up with things out of nowhere, because that's what they do sometimes. And so when the parents have gone to counseling, they now know how to talk to their children when something like this has happened or when something comes out of nowhere, because they're not quite sure how to react and what to say. And sometimes you don't even have to say anything. Sometimes it's just, mm-hmm, acknowledging what they're saying. And I think we are so quick at going to the dentist and going to the doctor for, you know, heartburn and what have you. But when we're having some emotions that we're having a difficult time dealing with, what do we do? I don't know. That's not for me. You know, unfortunately,
yeah.
that is how we think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I always try to encourage folks. The other part of that is this, especially when I'm talking with teenagers. You know, they're having a difficult time anyway. And the teenagers I would never go back to. You could give me a thousand, million, you know, more than there is enough, and I could never be convinced to go back to those years. But when you're having to discuss certain things that are very uncomfortable for you, you don't want to discuss those things with your parent. I don't know about you guys, but I didn't.
No, I didn't. Right.
Exactly. Right. They're very uncomfortable. And when you're sitting, you know, you're sitting across the table having dinner after you've disclosed all of these uncomfortable things, you're sitting there across the table going, my gosh, I wonder what they think. Oh, my gosh, I wonder if they feel differently about me, you know. So when you're going to a counselor that you don't have to go home and sit down and have dinner with, it's so much easier.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
usually
how I put it to some of these folks, and they're like, oh, yeah, that's right. I didn't think of it that way, you know. So there's a lot of things that we try to help victims, and I'm like Jackie, I hate using that word, but for lack of a better word, we have used the word victim. But when we speak with people who have come in needing assistance, who have been victims of violent crimes, or their family members, you know, we try to explain to them that all of the what you call abnormal things that you're doing or feeling are totally normal for an abnormal situation.
Mm-hmm. And that, I'm sure that helps them immensely. Just those words alone are, and they're because they're so true.
Very.
Mm-hmm.
I do have to say something though. When and Kim, like myself, we're both nurses or were nurses. I'm not anymore, but when Debbie died, I met a friend of mine, and I worked for her as a nurse many years ago. She's a great practitioner. Her name's Mary Marcus. And in her lunchtime, we just sat and had a quiet talk, and she said to me, and I always tell people this, Jackie, dreadful as it sounds, you only have two choices. You can live or you can die. And I took it as though I could either go and sit on the couch and crawl up into a ball and do nothing, or I could live and I could work and try and find Debbie's killer. And I chose life, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing what you can do. As I said, I was calling my television programs a week after we got back from Debbie's funeral.
And right there, that tells me you chose life, and what goes along with that, really hand in hand with that, is not only helping yourself, helping to find Debbie's killer, but you are out there now. You're focused too on helping other people. When you started the TV show, when you started on radio, you know your show is called The Victim's Voice, and sometimes I think people have a tendency to get too concerned with themselves, and they need to start focusing on their fellow man. It lessens their burden. Lisa, what do you think about that?
I think that's a very, very good point that you bring across. I think we're in such a state anymore where it's all about me, and it's all about, you know, I, me, fast, 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 and what can I benefit out of this? And I think that we've gotten so far away from our fellow man and the people next to us, and we don't realize, especially in a community such as Merced, you know, we're not very big. We've grown quite a bit, but we are all like puzzles interlocking. We really are, because you'd be amazed how many people I have even run across that have been teachers of my children or who have been, you know, a relative of a very close friend. It's just so amazing how connected we are. And I think once we realize that we have that connection and start at least looking at each other with some, and I hate to say it this way because it comes out so terribly, but to at least have some consideration and some compassion for one another. And, you know, it might sound hokey-pokey, but we live in such a different world anymore. I understand that. But I think that, you know, even the simple things of giving somebody a smile when perhaps they may have been contemplating suicide, and your giving them a smile has made such a difference in their life. It's that simple.
It is. And Jackie, and that's what you did too with when you went out and you decided to live. This is how you you managed to get through it, correct?
Well, nobody was going to kill my kid and get away with it, as far as I had life. And I'm sorry, I'm a former Brit. But I do have to tell you that if it weren't for people, and I'm going to drop a couple of names, and forgive me, like Mary Marcus and a young man called Dennis, who is now a congressman, Dennis Cardoza. I mean, I have had such wonderful people like our DA, Larry Morse, you know, Sheriff Pazin, and Sergeant Skinner, who all helped me. And I have always said that I am only as good as those who have helped me, because you cannot do it by yourself. And, you know, you can't get full of yourself, because I can get an award, but I'm getting it because of what I do. But I'm doing what I do because my child is dead.
Mm-hmm.
And basically that's it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can never get full of yourself, as I said before.
Right, exactly.
Jackie?
Yes, Denny. Hi,
I'd
how
like to...
are you? Can you believe it, all these women talking and you're being a quiet man? My God, that's the first anywhere.
I'd like to ask you a question, actually several questions for you and the other guests. I'll start with you, and we're obviously talking about Debbie. If you had to pick one word to describe Debbie, what would it be?
Heroine, yes, you know.
Would you explain that, please?
Well, I truly believe that I defy anyone to say differently, I truly believe that my daughter died silently so Courtney would not wake up, because, you know, they lived in 88, the homes, you know, the bedrooms are close to each other, and Courtney did not wake up, and Debbie was brutally murdered, and, you know, actually, people need to read the book, and, you know, to see that. And no, she's a hero. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, she is a hero.
And before I ask the next question, is there anybody who has any other website links they would like to give out? We've given out Angela's book site. Is there any other information on the web that you would like to give out or links to?
Well, I'm very bad about websites and computers. I went to Catholic school, and they didn't teach us how to do anything in England. But I can tell you that if people go on the web and they just punch in Citizens Against Homicide, they're this wonderful organization. They're victims also. They're nonprofit, and they're the ones that got me my billboard. And now the only credit I'll take is that I was their inspiration for the billboard, because I'm so proud of it. But now they get billboards for people all over America.
Jackie, what I'd like to do is...
they work very hard.
I'm going to ask you another question I think you'll be able to help me with, and then I'll move on, and I have questions for Angela and Lisa also. But one of the things about the story, Debbie's story and your story, is that this nine-year period went by. The police apparently... were doing the right things, but they just were having trouble coming up with the killer. And you decided not to let go. You decided, as we said a few minutes ago, to choose life and to do something. Now, Kim and I frequently talk with people whose children have been killed or have died. In some cases, they're upset because the police investigation they feel was inadequate and or maybe non-existent, and the death was determined to be an accident or a suicide when there is certain information it may have been a homicide. We have other cases where they're just the cold cases, like Debbie's was for quite some time. And these people in those situations can get very frustrated, obviously. And one of the things that I hear frequently is the lack of answers. They can't get answers from anybody, or answers that they can understand, or answers that make sense. So I'm gonna go start with you, Jackie. Do you find, when you were in the situation where the case apparently had gone cold, or dealing with guests on your shows, your TV and radio shows, do you find the same frustration? Do you talk to people that are experiencing the frustration you felt or that Kim and I have encountered with some of our other guests?
You know, and I, of course, and I felt the same frustration because the thing is, they cannot tell you much or anything because, you know, we have a habit of confiding in people maybe we shouldn't confide in, and things may get out and twisted around that shouldn't be. And another thing is that we don't have enough police. You know, you may have like half a dozen homicide detectives and goodness knows how many cases, and we have to remember that they are only as good as the information that's given them. You know, they have to have information coming in. And so I just tell people to be patient and make an appointment. Just go and sit down and talk to them and explain your feelings. And we have, I mean, the police in Modesto, they were great. Actually, one of my detectives is now the chief, Mike Hardin. He was great. The detectives here in Merced, I am such a nuisance with Sergeant Skinner, and he always says, it's okay, Jackie, bug me, you know, wanting to come either on radio or television and profile some cases with some victims. So I have, you know, I really don't have any complaints here locally. And I think even Lisa will attest to that, won't you, Lisa?
Absolutely.
Not to put you on the spot. Just remember that if it hadn't been that Ed Steele, now a sergeant, hadn't respected Michael Warnell, the man that finally came forward when he arrested him with respect, that maybe this wouldn't have happened. Maybe he wouldn't have confided in him and Debbie's case wouldn't have been solved. You know, I had the time and energy to keep her face out there, and they had the expertise and the knowledge of how to find him. Because he was in Flippin, Arkansas.
Yes. Now, on your shows, do you get people who want to be guests or are guests have had different experiences with the government agencies, police agencies, or other governmental agencies?
Well, basically, what I do is I invite a police officer to profile a case. And then I always tell him to please bring a family member, because I don't want people to think of the person as a victim that has died. I want them to think of him as somebody who is missed, or she who is missed and loved by their family. And so you put a face on them with their mother or their, you know, a husband or a family member. And I always tell I always call them coppers because I'm English. And anyway, my half-brother's son was a copper in London. I always tell them, you know, this is not my program. This is your program, and whatever you say goes. So nothing inappropriate is either said or spoken about. And that's how it should be. And most of the time, people want to come back on.
Oh, no, that's certainly a compliment.
I know that I have to get off the air in a minute, but can I please give you my favorite quotation, which is my speech normally, and it's from Aristotle. Are you listening, Lisa?
Yes, I am.
There's a reason I said that. And it's, justice will only be achieved when those not injured by crime are as indignant about it as those who are. And I encourage everyone to be indignant and come forward if you ever have any information about any kind of crime or mistreatment, even of animals, because I love animals. Thank you,
mm-hmm.
Dennis.
Well, you're welcome. Angela.
Yes, sir.
Yes, first, my compliments on the book.
Thank you.
Excellent job. And how tough was it really for you to write that book? First, did you have second thoughts about it when Jackie approached you to do it? And did you ever, as you were actually writing the manuscript, were you ever tempted, did it ever get so tough for you or so difficult or uncomfortable that you were tempted either to quit or wish you hadn't have gotten involved?
That's a twofold kind of answer I've got to give you, because the book, No Room for Doubt, that's not what I started out to write. I started out wanting to provide a blueprint for how this mother found justice for her murdered daughter, and how other people who were seeking justice could use some of those same techniques to find the answers to their questions. And when Jackie approached me about writing the book, I had no hesitation. I think my only question was, what do you mean there's not already a book about, you know, about this and about what you've done? So I jumped at the chance as a journalist, and then, you know, later, I guess, as somebody who was intimately connected with the case, that ended up to be an advantage, although at the time that I agreed to do it, I had a real concern about being able to follow through with it and keep myself out of it. So, you know, again, what I thought we were doing was just sort of a glorified pamphlet. We would leave it with DA's offices and, you know, just try to get the word out wherever we could in the survivors' community. And it wasn't until I started researching that case for the first time, you know, now as an adult and a journalist, that I realized the tremendous body of evidence that pointed to my father and understood what he had gone through at the same time that Jackie was making her very victorious journey. You know, my father was really self-destructing, and I had never really understood the reasons for that until I sat down with those detectives and that file and just saw it all in front of me. And at that point, I realized that maybe it was too neat to put our family's story in a package with a pretty bow on top, even though there's tremendous hope and inspiration in what Jackie did. You know, that's not the path that everybody walks. And, you know, some people don't make it out of that valley of darkness. I'm so glad that there are people who have, like Jackie and so many other victims' advocates that I've met on this journey, but that's not always the case. And then I think finally I realized, oh my gosh, there are people who think my dad is in jail today for killing his wife. You know, and the first time I talked to one person who believed that, I thought, I have to set the record straight. And so then it sort of became a bigger project, and one that I probably wouldn't have done if I had known what I was getting myself into, but I'm so glad I did.
So it worked out well.
It did. You know, you can't be around Jackie McDonald and wuss out on the hard stuff. You just can't.
Your feet are held to the fire.
Am I not a fortunate woman?
Lisa?
I have to, you know what, I have to agree with what what she says, because Jackie calls me sometimes and I can't tell her no. And there's only two people that I can't tell no, and she's one of them.
See, now the world knows, Lisa, so you can't
say
that. Yeah,
no kidding.
But I'd like to, if I could ask you a question about your job.
Absolutely.
You know, dealing with, I know we don't like to use the term, but I am lacking being able to think of another one at the moment, victims. It's got to be very rewarding when you can help somebody, when you help somebody to get through the process, and whether it's a successful resolution to a prosecution and so forth, that's got to make you feel very good. But dealing with people who are going through hard times and have been victimized, are you able to keep from getting emotionally involved with cases? Do you try to keep from getting emotionally involved? And if things don't work out well, if the prosecution is not successful and maybe somebody gets away with one, do you have any defense mechanisms to protect your emotional well-being from getting too caught up in various cases?
Certainly do, and I'll tell you a great example. First of all, let me just say this. You have to have some level of emotion, but I think you really have to learn how to keep that balance. what you see on a daily basis, what you read and what you deal with in this office on a daily basis can really take a toll on you. And you can't go through the experience of seeing and reading without having some kind of emotion, but you certainly have to have a balance. And I'll tell you, in one particular instance, when I first started here, I started off as an advocate. The very first case that I dealt with, actually was the second case, it was a homicide case. And I was dealing with two young ladies and a mom. And it was very difficult for me. I knew a while back that I'm not one of those people who could be a nurse because blood just drives me nuts. I donate blood, and sometimes I will pass out, but I feel it's important to donate blood. I know that's crazy. But I have to psych myself up for something like that. So what I know is this. When you are getting ready to go into trial and you're assisting a family who you know the pictures are going to be shown, and my thing is this, I don't ever want to remember my loved one that way. I want to remember them the way I remember them. I don't want to remember those pictures. I don't want to see those pictures. And many times, most people feel the same. So what I have done when I don't want to see those pictures is I have this mental block. I see the pictures, but I don't see the pictures. And that's just something that has worked for me, okay? It doesn't work for everybody. Everybody has to find their own way of how to, you know, deal with that sort of thing and how to kind of put things into perspective and have a balance. I think when things really get to me is usually the sentencing stage, because you have pretty much grown through all of these emotions with this family. You have dealt with everything that they're experiencing, of course, at a different level. But nonetheless, you have built the rapport with them. They have a tremendous amount of trust in you. And I take that very serious, because when somebody comes to me trusting me and telling me these things, to me, that is something very precious. Mm-hmm. And people aren't very quick to trust anyway. So I take that very personal, and I you know, it's very precious to me. So there's different ways every person has to deal with that. And usually that's what I tell our advocates. You have to find what works for you, because what works for me may not work for you. And they have. And I can see them walking in from a sentencing, and I can tell from their body language and how they hold their head whether or not it has really affected them. And in most cases it has, because we have a very compassionate staff here. And they have a passion also for what they do. And I believe very strongly that when you have a passion for something that you are doing, you're going to do it darn well. And people are going to know it. If you don't have a passion for what you're doing, it's just going to be a routine thing, and people are going to catch on and see that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
I think I can speak for all of us. But, you know, it has been very difficult. When I first started, it was very hard for me to deal with some of the photos, some of the readings of police reports, you know, talking to the detectives and telling them some of the things that, you know, they discovered. But you learn to put it into perspective, and I think I have learned to kind of block the visuals out. Even though it's sitting in front of my face in a projector, I've learned to block it out. And you learn also communication with your folks that you're dealing with. You've learned that communication so that you know when and what kind of cue to give them to let them know the pictures are coming up, okay? They either turn away or they decide to walk out. You also build that communication where the attorney gives you a cue, either looks back at you to let you know, hey, the photos are going up. Therefore, you let your family know the photos are going up in a very quiet, you know, in a very quiet way, but you've developed that communication. So there's different ways of dealing with things, and I think it depends on your personality. And it depends, because all the attorneys here know, I don't need to see pictures. I'm good, thank you. I'm okay. There are sometimes I read reports, and I can't read them all the way through that day because it's just too much for me. You really have to be in tune with who you are. You have to know who you are, and you also have to know how much you can handle. And I think that's one of the key parts, is knowing what you can handle and knowing yourself well enough to know those things. Does that help?
Yes, it certainly does, and I agree that, you know, every individual is different, and they have to develop what works best for them. And but you got to have, I think, something, because there's these types of jobs that you got to have some type of mechanism to defend yourself.
You do. And there are times, you know, I walk back from court sometimes after a sentencing, and it hit me really hard, because I think that's when it hits you hard, is that you're towards the end of this entire case that you've been dealing with. It doesn't mean that you're done dealing with the family, because luckily the family still keeps in touch with you, and I love when they do that. I have families that come in periodically and see me once a year, once every couple of years. I just saw a family that I had helped about 6 years ago, you know, and it's wonderful to see them. And we live in such a small community. You're going to run into folks. But it's so wonderful to see that they are doing well, and they've, you know, I remember them every time the anniversary comes up. It's just, that's who I am. You know, I can't help it. Those are just things that I hold sometimes. But you learn to put them into perspective. And when I'm coming back from a sentencing, you know, I have my time alone. Sometimes I have to take a drive and just kind of, you know, refresh and regroup and decompress. Because I think it's very important to develop a way to decompress, even when I go home. The first thing I do is take my shoes off, go to my room, and decompress, because my room's my sanctuary, you know.
Yes,
know that.
Thank you, Lisa. Jackie, I'm going to turn it back over to Kim, but before the time ends, I want to get back with you about a couple of things. One is the stamina issue and how you developed so quickly your strategy, and then I know also that you want to discuss something about a law you're trying to get implemented or enacted. So, before the end of the show, I'll follow up with that. Hey, Kim.
Yes. Okay. Jackie, what one of the questions we had in our chat room was, what, in looking back in hindsight, do you have any advice on how families can help develop leads, lead possibilities, or gather info?
For me, it's publicity. I'm sorry.
Publicity, right. It's just media, right?
And I got very smart, and I shouldn't say that, but every year on her anniversary, I mean, where we live, we get our satellite from Fresno, and where Debbie, and then Debbie, of course, is Modesto. And so I would call both a different channel in both places, Modesto and Fresno. So I got double the publicity, and I always called a different station. And I always planned something, you know, so that I could get her story out on the anniversary. And, you know, the more you do it and the more you connect with people, the easier it becomes to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and what you do is, I had, if I may drop her name again, Darrell Farnsworth was reporter for the Modesto Bee, and Carol Benson had a radio program, and every year they would do Debbie's story. And we're great friends even to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I have another name for victims that I think of in my mind, and it's the walking wounded. You're a nurse, so you know that, what that means.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
That's what we are, the walking wounded.
Mm-hmm. And exactly.
But people need to know that once you have an arrest and you go to trial, dreadful as it is, that you're no longer a victim, because you have your power back, because now you know who and why. And so basically the positions are reversed. They're your victim.
Right, exactly. And speaking of the outcome of this, the killer did tell one person,
just
and that
one
person. And he finally came forward, and the killer was a very young, I think he was 18, wasn't he?
He was 18, he was high on methamphetamine.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have a very crude reply for that. He knew how to undo a zipper, and I can't be polite, I'm sorry.
He knew
my daughter. But, of course, you know, she was dead, so that was easy, wasn't it?
Mm. Thank God.
I'm glad she was dead, but because she was dead, I get the phone call from the DA that's, you know, prosecuting him a few days before trial, saying, we're going to take a plea. And I said, I don't want it. And he said, we're taking a plea, because if you rape a dead woman, it's not a crime.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Anyway, it's a long story. It's like a mini series, isn't it? I'm sorry.
Yeah, it is. And Angela, I there was something that you had told me, and I believe it was in the book too. It is either something your father had said, because that poor man, really, what he went through, and like you said, he didn't seem to, he wasn't able to climb out of it, unfortunately. It was something like, we seek our truth of a situation because we want to know why and hold someone accountable. And it is human nature to filter realities, truths, because it does not fit with our truths.
Yeah.
So that's why, to explain that a little more if you can.
Sure. That wasn't something that my dad said, although it's certainly something that he came to understand very intimately, because really the whole community, a lot of people in the community, believed that he was guilty. And, you know, I think that unfortunately, that's just, that is part of human nature. And, you know, we see a beautiful young mother who, in this case, was murdered in her home. We want to find somebody and hold them responsible. And so we construct a truth about that situation.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And, you know, for
ignoring.
The people, that's right. And for the people who, you know, believe so strongly in that truth, sometimes they do filter out other things that might disrupt that vision of the truth for them. You know, when Jackie's efforts brought forward this informant and an arrest was made, this was a huge deal. National media came. I mean, it was just a big deal. And I can't imagine the size of some of the blinders on some of the people who lived there,
mm-hmm.
that they would miss all of that and
right.
continue to believe, you know. I mean, we have DNA evidence. We've got the right guy.
Right, right.
There's not a question mark there anymore. But mm-hmm. because some people had already constructed their truths, they've filtered out that whole big, massive moment in the media. And,
right.
you know,
right.
honestly, I it's easy to sit here and say, oh, shame on them. But it really does make me wonder, what am I filtering out?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting take, because I think that happens. It happens all the time. I see it happening all the time with the way people filter, you know, realities and just want to believe what they want to believe, and that's all there is to it. Jackie, one thing that when we had talked, you had wanted to also cover what could have been for Debbie, and that's something you do think about is what could have been.
Yes.
And that's hard, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, she would have. She has a daughter who's married, who has a little girl, Lily
Aww.
Anna, and you know, and a husband, of course. But she would have been a wonderful grandma. She would have had such fun, wouldn't she, Angela? Just you know,
yeah,
being a
she would have.
And seeing Courtney grow. So.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it doesn't matter how rotten her sister or I feel. Debbie's dead, and that's what's important, that she didn't get a chance to live her life to the fullest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she'd only had one job all her life. She was going to be the first, they told her, the first female manager at Sears. She was an assistant store manager, and that was her dream. She just loved being in retail,
mm-hmm.
and she was very good at it.
And she started at Sears. She was quite young.
Yeah. Yes, and that's the only job she had until her death.
Mm.
And so it's just, you know, so many possibilities.
Now, I thought maybe, Denny, if this is okay, if we can get to Debbie's Law. I do want to talk about that. Because a lot of the time, Jackie, you feel that Debbie really never received full justice because
no,
of the rape.
No.
And this is an interesting fact that couldn't believe this when you told me. It was just the laws definitely need to be changed. But it wasn't a crime, apparently. It's not a crime to rape someone after they're dead. And tell us about how the message you want and what you want, what changes you hope will come to the legislation.
Well, actually, as soon as I found out about Debbie being raped after death, I called Dennis Cardoza, who is our assemblyman then, and we went to the legislature to try and have the law passed, and it failed. And I was really surprised. I mean, the people that were opposing it. After that, Barbara Matthews, Dennis became our congressman. Barbara Matthews was our assembly person. She took it, and it reached the Appropriations Committee. And then, of course, it got dropped. And we have a very good assemblywoman now, but I don't know if she'll be able to take it. You know, there's so many issues. They're letting people out of jail. There's no money. And so we may still have to wait a while. I mean, it took 9 years to find her killer. It took more than that to get the book written. And so we just hope that if, like with programs like yours, if we can get the story out and ask people to please call their assembly people, become indignant, and maybe we can get it passed. Maybe not this year, maybe not next year, but hopefully in our lifetime we can get it passed.
I just find it absurd that anyone would oppose that. Angela, what are your thoughts on that? That just is absurd.
You know, I really sat down and looked at this legal process, and I think we've got a really good chance of blocking up this hole in the legal system. But unfortunately, when you go to revise a law, so much rests on word choice. And, you know, the first time that it went up, use of the word rape was offensive to people who had survived rape, because so much of that experience is the aftermath of that experience. Another problem was that the first time it went up, there was this idea that it should be an automatic death sentence. And that's going to bring in people who are against the death penalty no matter what. So I think, the second time, they took it through, what did they do, Jackie? They took it through like health, some kind of health issue, which was a bizarre way to take
it. And I do know in the beginning it was, and forgive me, it was life without parole. Or death, and the thing is that people read what they want to, and they saw death, so they didn't see life without parole.
Right. That's
another
right.
Reality. Another reality check, right?
That's right.
Is that people see what they want to see? But and of course, as we know, there's no money now, is there? They don't want to keep people in jail longer than they have to.
Right. That's right. So it's a horrible time to try to increase anybody's a jail time. But I think what Jackie and I keep coming down to is that whether you view our justice system as either punishment or a means to reform, you can't accomplish either of those things if you're not honest about what the problem is. Who can fix anything if you don't address the problem? And so that's really, you know, regardless of penalties or, you know, if we leave it in a judge's discretion or whatever, if we can just get it on the person's record, which it's not right now. It's not unless you work with corpses, as far as I understand California law. Yeah. We can even get that on record. That's such a huge step. So that's kind of what we're aiming for now, and I'm very hopeful that getting a face and a name on this cause will bring it some more support the next time that we can get it in front of the legislature.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. But
Jenny,
you know, as long as people are aware of it, that's what I want them to be.
Denny, are you surprised that this isn't anything short of a felony or?
Well, it's, to be quite honest, it's not you know, the type of thing you think about all that up because you don't read about it.
Right.
it certainly should be. Now that it's been brought to my attention, I understand, though, why maybe there were some problems introducing it, or as far as getting action on it, because some people may have seen the death business, and I think it was Angela that said some people are opposed to a death penalty no matter what the crime is. So there may have been a little confusion there that could have cost some of the momentum. And I don't know if some people are just reluctant to use the same terminology, perhaps, for that they would apply to a live victim, a deceased person. You know, I don't know. Everybody might have little hang-ups regarding terminology or confusion about whether there's a death penalty involved and so forth. But I've almost got to think that it would cause, if could be presented to eliminate some of those concerns or confusion, it would seem to me that it would make people's blood boil, and they would definitely want something done to stiffen the penalties for anybody that commits, well, it should be a crime. Right now it's not a crime, but it should be made a crime, and whoever does it and is convicted of it should get a stiff jolt.
Denny, while you were saying that, it reminded me of one of the groups that objected to, I think it was the second run that we took with Debbie's Law. And at that point, the wording had been changed to something like sexual contact with a deceased person or sexual contact with a corpse. And somebody actually said, so you're telling me that if a boyfriend murders his girlfriend and then kisses her lips in remorse, that should be an additional crime? I mean, some of these arguments just go into the land of the bizarre. And
yes.
I think, and that's just part of the political arena and or circus.
Yeah, and it's very tough to overcome that. I've known in the chat room here there's been a few mentions of political correctness and so forth, and it's a tough thing, because somebody can always find something to take offense over if they look at something. There are always going to be people, like you say, bizarre, but people like that are out there, and they're going to make an issue of anything.
Right, that's right. And, you know, certainly if people want more of a definition than just sexual contact, I mean, I can understand. Laws are all about being specific. So, sure, we can do that, and hopefully we'll get a chance to do that.
I was trying to think. Now, it's been years since I was in law enforcement back in New York, but and I could be in error on this, but my recollection is that at the time, I'm going back, you know, 20-some years, that rape required an act of force or the use of a drug or chemical to make the victim, put the victim in a state of being unable to defend herself.
Right.
So I'm just thinking, if I'm correct on that, and if that is still the law, it may not be, but the definition was the same, then probably New York, that wouldn't have, you know, as far as a rape charge, would not be able to apply, because if you're dealing with an object that can't defend itself, I mean, you don't have to use force, and there was, you know, if there was no, unless the murder was maybe accomplished through the use of a drug or something. But I'm thinking this over, and I can see where there have to be wording would have to be just right.
Exactly. And right now in California, I can't speak to other states, but right now in California, a victim of rape must be alive. She can be unconscious, he could be unconscious, but the person has to be alive. And because we could not prove, because the prosecutors could not prove that Debbie was alive when this happened, You know, it just never got entered onto the perpetrator's record. And that's frightening on so many levels. I mean, take our family out of it, take my stepmother out of it, it's still frightening because that kill involved a sexual component. And, you know, how often is this happening? And we don't hear about it because the law has this loophole in it that hasn't been filled with something else. You don't want to call it rape, okay. But let's call it something and get it on the record.
Right.
I just noticed there's some talk in the chat room back and forth mentioning that if there's some type of, we'll use this term, sexual contact, they corpse, say, at a funeral home.
Yes.
Or a medical examiner's office, is that a crime? Well, obviously, you know, it'll depend on the jurisdiction, but I can tell you I investigated a medical examiner's office in central New York several years ago, and one of the deals was they had a pedophile working as a morgue attendant.
Mm-hmm.
And when nobody was around, he invited some of his associates in to the morgue, and they took liberties with the bodies of children.
Yes.
And certainly despicable, disgusting, but my recollection was that they couldn't be charged with a sexual crime in that. Now, you know, again, it's been this case like 25 years ago. My memory is a little cloudy, but I remember there was it was very difficult to come up with a charge serious enough for that
right.
type of situation. And I'll tell you, we found photographs of what happened, and the faces of the child, in one case, the face of the child was visible, and so that corpse could have been identified. And the district attorney intervened and took possession under grand jury subpoena of those photos. And he told me, he said, if these ever got out, he said, I know the parents of this child would kill the perpetrator and the kid who let the perpetrator in the building.
Right.
So, I mean, it was, again, I use the term blood boil. It was a situation where people would have certainly been subject to violence, not from the legal standpoint, but because they'd have been enraged.
Right. And
my knowledge that that was never corrected as far as a new law or a law to address an issue like that, which is a shame.
Yeah.
You know, I called the British Embassy when I, you know, I found out by telephone why they were taking a plea bargain, because if you rape a dead woman, it's not a crime. And at that time, it wasn't a crime in England, but I believe it is now because I've called the embassy back. So there's still a hope for us.
Yeah. Angela, you mentioned that they couldn't prove that she was alive, but could they prove she was dead?
Well, they have forensic pathologists, and they're the ones that said that my daughter was raped after death.
Oh, so they
decided it was so brutal she wouldn't have lived more than a couple of minutes.
Mm.
And that's the only thing that, you know, gets you going. I'm sitting here feeling a bit queasy, if you want to know the truth, because it starts coming back in your brain what happened.
Well, I certainly hope that that law can gets passed. I pray it does, and I'm sure you and Angela will work very hard on that,
and please,
because that's something that needs to be done.
And the people in your chat rooms, I mean, they seem interested, so if they would help work out, just call their legislature. You know, it's an election year.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder what the laws are here. And I can't believe, Denny, that they would think that that's not a sex crime.
Now, as we were discussing earlier, it's all a matter, I think, of the terminology. You know, talking like this, we all agree it is, or should be.
Right.
Down to the legal aspects of it. And the, you know, the there's always a few monkey wrenches that seem to come into play. And it's a shame because I think common sense should dictate a lot of times, and never mind the legalese.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, let's see, where does that bring us now? Anything that anybody would like to add? Go ahead.
No, I just want, you know, to also mention again, of course, Citizens Against Homicide, who got me my billboard, who got me in the bus system, and that if people need help, you know, to go on their computer and contact them, they have a monthly flyer, and you can profile your case, and it goes to many police departments besides regular homes, and you know, they're nonprofit, they're victims themselves, and they do a great job. And I have to attest to that. Thank Angela, and I have to thank Lisa. That's, you know, that can't say no to me, and she shouldn't have said that on the air. Because she really can't. And we have to have a little joke, don't we? But I want to thank Angela. I could have had the book written before, but I refused. And I really wanted Angela to do it because she knew Debbie, and she loved Debbie, and that's very important, and that's what makes a difference when the book was written.
Oh, yes. It's an excellent book. Very well written. I couldn't put it down.
Oh, it really is. And, of course, if anybody in England is listening to this, I was Jackie O'Brien, so you know how to get hold of me now.
Jackie O'Brien, and where did you work? What was the name of the hospital over in England?
It was Bishop Stortford, and there was Jean Williams and Terry Carr and June Smith. We were all in the same class together with Sister Hamilton, who didn't like you to wear makeup. So those were the days, my friend, when you dated just to get something to eat. Because the food was so awful. I know.
Say Jackie?
Yes, Denny.
Yeah, I did want to follow up on something while we got a few minutes left.
Thank you.
The stamina and the drive. Now, you determined fairly quickly that what you wanted to do was keep the story alive, and you went looking for media venues to get the story out there on, looking to develop leads and keep the story going. Did that kind of just come to you automatically, that media was the way to go? Did you have to consult with people to say, what should I do? Or
no,
was it kind of a natural thing where you just knew that was the right thing to do?
Well, when Debbie died, there was, you know, there was not all the organizations that there are now. So I was sort of on my own. But I do have to tell you that I give a great deal of credit, most of the credit, to my husband, my second husband, Dennis, who, if you read the book, you'll see in the back, I thank him for making the journey from tragedy to triumph possible, because without him, I would be nothing.
And it's
the truth. He put his life on hold for me.
Did you ever, Jackie, I obviously this dragged on for 9 years. Did there ever come a time when you weren't getting return phone calls from some of these, say, the most wanted or some of these TV venues you were seeking out? Did there ever come a time where you were ready to throw in the towel? Did that ever enter your mind that maybe it was just a losing cause?
No, I'm British, so being a pain in the you-know-what was part of my nature. I'm sorry.
And we
had
a question posed here in the chat room. Did you ever fear the killer might come after you?
Do you know, I never thought of that, honestly.
Angela, how about you with that question?
Well, considering the breather in the bedroom, the police actually didn't allow me to go to Debbie's funeral because of that. They felt that if that had been the killer, he may think that I could identify him, and therefore they asked me to stay away, and it got very cloak and dagger for a while there for me, and eventually I had to move to the other side of the country.
Well, you know, I'd like to ask all three of you ladies something. I'm sure Jackie knows, but some associates and I are putting together a show. Hopefully we're going to end up on TV with it, called Crime Wire. And it's, I think, quite similar to Jackie's shows. And our intent and hope is to help people get bring attention to their cases. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be going were there cold cases, maybe fairly current cases, and also some cases of suspicious deaths where perhaps the survivors, the walking wounded, I think was used, aren't because the death certificate, the coroner's ruling or medical examiner's ruling, might be accident or suicide, yet there's substantial, credible evidence that there may have been foul play. And I guess in some jurisdictions or some states, unless a homicide has been ruled, people aren't eligible for some of the assistance from some of these various programs. So our show is going to address, hopefully, some of those issues and try to get exposure to people who are battling the system and are frustrated and don't have the wherewithal financially or emotionally to continue the fight. I'm wondering, I don't know where Lisa would stand here employment-wise. I don't want to ask her to do anything that she shouldn't do. But I was wondering if all three of you would maybe be willing to talk with us and give us, as we're finalizing our program and agenda, some thoughts or some guidance about, based on your experiences, the specific areas we need to target or pay special attention to, or maybe some of the problems and so on and so forth. Is there anything you ladies would be interested in doing?
I would be honored to help you.
Absolutely.
Any way we could. I think it's great that you're going to be doing this, Danny, because we all need all the help we can get. And there's just too many walking wounded victims out there that need help.
And, Jackie, I was telling the people, the production company called Two Real Productions in Henderson, Nevada, about you and what you did and also your shows. And they said to ask you if sometime if we came to pay you a visit, if we could shoot the breeze with you. And
oh, my gosh, that would be wonderful. And if somebody would give Angela a free ticket, she could come and shoot the breeze too, because Lisa and I live close to each other.
Well, we would love to do that. So.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
And it's pretty sneaky of me to pin you down right on the air here.
For
that, after I said it, it probably looks a little tacky, but I didn't intend it to be.
Lisa's already packing her suitcase or whatever. Oh, I should say Angela. No, that would be wonderful. Thank you so much. It would be an honor, I know, for all of us. And then there's a little bit more to Debbie's story, which you may not want to talk about, but Debbie's ghost was seen in the house.
Really?
And
yes.
I knew nothing about it until we did my story. Citizens told me to do my story, and I said, isn't that a little arrogant? And they said no, and the grandma started talking about her very small grandson, and he would play with this lady. But the kicker was that she took him to Save Mart and went to put him in a shopping cart, and he started screaming, don't sit on her, don't sit on her. And my daughter's photo was in the shopping cart, who murdered Debbie.
No way.
The photo, yeah.
Actually, it's in Leslie Rule's book, Coast to Coast Ghost, and Debbie was the friendly ghost.
That's amazing. My goodness.
Yeah, and, you know, children are very sensitive anyway. But mm-hmm. I know it's gone. But I always felt her spirit was there, and that never frightened me.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are down to our last minute, and so I think it's probably time to say goodnight. I cannot thank you enough, Jackie, for coming on the program with us tonight and telling of Debbie's story. And Angela, no kidding, that book was fantastic. It is
a fantastic
book, and I hope everybody gets a chance to read it. And Lisa, you are such a remarkable person. I cannot thank you enough for being on with us tonight and for all your insights, and you have such a heart. I can feel it from here, so every time I talk to you, I can feel it. So
you realize
I just want
to. I'm going to have to make an appointment to see her. after all this training.
Yes.
You don't ever need an appointment. You know that.
I'm joking. We are so blessed to have her in Victim Witness.
Yes, definitely. Well, thank you so much, everyone. And Denny, you want to have the last word?
Well, I just want to, again, ditto on that. Thank you very much. It's certainly been informative. And, Jackie, I'll be in touch with you, and we'll work something out to get together, and you can give us a hand. And
gosh,
also with Angela and Lisa.
You know, it's too bad you can't come up for April the 20th, Crime Victims Day, because everybody is there.
Thank you.
April 20th.
Yeah.
Victims' Rights Ceremony.
Yeah.
I'll look into that.
Oh, great, because everyone's going to be there, and if Angela's there too, it would be perfect.
Okay, I'll get back to you on that. Thank you very much again.
Thanks, Jenny.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.